It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll share some things you never knew about the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life. First, two lawmakers toured Lincoln Hill's Copper Lake School yesterday to see the facility and talk to the community about alleged abuse there. Earlier this month, state officials raided the school for juvenile inmates after reports of widespread staff abuses ranging from sexual assault to suffocation. Now the FBI and the State Justice Department are investigating those allegations. Representative Mandela Barnes toured Lincoln Hills yesterday, and he's with us now to talk about that experience. He's a Democratic state representative for the 11th District, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Barnes, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again, and good afternoon to you and your listeners. How's everything going your way?
Now, why did you decide to visit Lincoln Hills personally yesterday?
Well, it's one of those things. You hear the allegations, you read the reports, and, you know, you can make any assumption you want, but if you have the ability to, you know, go experience something like that in person, as the ranking member on the Assembly Committee on Corrections, and Representative Goyke being the ranking member of this committee, we felt it was very important to make the trip up there. Parents have to make the trip if they want to go visit their children, and this being an issue of huge concern to both of us, we felt it necessary to make that trip ourselves.
Now, what was your reaction when you first heard about the abuse allegations coming out of Lincoln Hills?
Well, some of the things were so wild. You know, when you hear it, when you read it in the paper, it's like you think of like some of the worst places imaginable. Some of the, like the scene off of movies where, or you see jails and prisons, you know, just overrun and going crazy, like on the Batman movies, right? Like Arkham Asylum. You think of like the wildest scenarios. Then you think, oh, these are children who are in these facilities. It's no better. They were adults. However, you know, these are inmates, many of whom can, you know, be corrected if properly rehabilitated. So that's where, when you read it, it strikes you. I'm a younger person myself. I'm only 29 years old, so not too much older than some of the people who are in there. So reading it, seeing the reports, that's exactly what prompted the reaction for us to just go there.
And so you maybe had some ideas about what you might find and what the situation was like. What was it actually like when you got there?
Well, that's the thing. You can't properly, you know, gauge or say, well, yeah, nothing's going on because I went there and saw nothing was going on. The fact is, you know, prior to us going there, they had advance warning that we would actually be there. So I had very little expectation that we would see some of the things we heard about actually take place while we were there. However, we did have an opportunity to speak with people. We had a chance to speak with, you know, students that we passed by, and we also had an opportunity to speak with people who worked there who were able to provide, you know, more context, more detail about what has been taking place and what are some of the bigger issues.
We're talking right now with Mandela Barnes, Democratic State Representative for the 11th District, and he's joining us now to talk about his in-person visit to Lincoln Hills yesterday, which is under investigation for staff abuse against juvenile inmates. And talking about what some of the underlying issues are and the reform that's needed, what sorts of conclusions have you come to about what could fix some of the problems that have surfaced?
Well, some of the bigger problems stem from political decisions that were made. And, this is absolutely not the type of these are not the type of events that you want to politicize in any way. However, political decisions have had real-life consequences on so many people. When you look at the rate of people who have been retiring or who have just abruptly resigned from the Department of Corrections, who work at staff in this facility as well as other facilities across the state, you have seen a sharp decline since 2011-2012, and in my opinion and the opinion of many others, this can be directly attributed to Governor Walker's Act 10 reforms, because this is a workplace where people are not able to negotiate their own safety. Governor Walker exempted police officers and firefighters for this very reason, completely ignoring the fact that our prison system, our Department of Corrections, is another place where people are likely to witness some form of danger on the job. So when people go to work every day, when they're forced into overtime, 16-hour shift after 16-hour shift after 16-hour shift, there is a certain cognitive ability that doesn't exist after a certain point. There is a certain level of tolerance that a person has. You know, I make the comparison all the time. It doesn't matter where you work. So you could work at a Build-A-Bear for two straight 16-hour shifts, and you may not be the most pleasant employee, and something small could sing you off. The fact that we have people who are committed to working these types of hours, working in these situations where they have very little say-so on their own safety, on their own well-being, you're going to see catastrophic results. You're going to see more and more reports like this. And I'm afraid that, you know, it's much more than even Lincoln Hills. I'm especially concerned about our adult correction system.
Well, one issue that this has brought to light is the question of how, what type of consequence is most effective when you're dealing with juveniles, and then I guess if you look at the broader prison system, older people involved in that as well. What do you think about how we think about corrections and consequences and punishment?
So we have to be more forward-thinking in our adult corrections as well as our juvenile corrections. And Representative Evan Goyke and I released a proposal that will require the Wisconsin Department of Corrections to examine, to study the benefits of the Missouri model. They use a much different model in that state when it comes to juvenile corrections. As you know, Lincoln Hills is a facility that is it's primarily made up of students from Milwaukee County. And the fact is that we're talking about a place that's 3.5 hours away. Even if you have a car, even if you're able to go there, we're talking about 7 hours total travel time back and forth. Let's say you spend 2-3 hours with your child who's there. That's a 10-hour commitment, which is difficult for any person, regardless of, whether you're working class, whether you're not working, whatever the case may be, that is a difficult situation. One piece of the Missouri model calls for smaller facilities spread out in different geographical regions in a state to make it easier for students to be able to, or juvenile offenders to be able to interact with their parents, which is also a huge part of the rehabilitation process. It involves parents, it involves families. About 25% students that go through that type of rehabilitation program also undergo a family therapy program before they are released, which has been shown to tremendously increase the chance or decrease the chances of them returning to a juvenile facility or an adult facility later in life.
So speaking about different locations for schools as one possibility, the state chapter of the NAACP is calling for the state to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake schools and to reopen the Ethan Allen School, which is closer to Milwaukee. What do you think about that proposal?
Well, I think that the proposal to reopen Ethan Allen, I don't think it should have been closed in the first place. I understand that the idea to consolidate was put forth. However, we knew, it had been talked about. I wasn't even in the legislature at this point, but it had been discussed. It had been talked about the consequences that so many of the students there would face by, being so far removed from their families. Another thing is, cultural competency. That's huge because when you look at the staff in these types of facilities, it helps. It is immensely helpful when you have staff that can directly relate to some of the experiences of the inmates. Unfortunately, as much as a staff person, may care about the livelihood, the fact that if there is some level of relativity that exists between staff members who are working to rehabilitate these students, whether it's the caseworker, social workers, when that exists, you tend to see better results.
Now, what do you think needs to happen, both to make Lincoln Hills safe immediately and to reform the school, maybe change it?
Well, the big part, when you look immediately for the safety, we need more staff. When you're looking at a facility that is constantly understaffed, you're looking at the staff turnover rate. If people do get the job, the amount of people who stay or who don't stay because of the forced overtime, that's a huge issue. We have to be able to attract, recruit, attract, and retain dedicated professionals who are willing, who are able to serve in this sort of capacity. That's one of the biggest things. I mean, you look at the training that takes place in years past, you know, the training happened between senior staff and the incoming staff, and they were able to be brought in the position. They were able to be transitioned more smoothly. And now you get people who just kind of, you know, they go through a training and it's not as thorough, and they show up for work and certain situations may arise and they don't have anybody to look to. They don't have anybody to consult who's also in that position when they when certain situations arise.
Well, Representative Barnes, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mandela Barnes, Democratic State Representative for the 11th District, which includes Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about his recent visit to Lincoln Hills yesterday, which is under investigation for staff abuse against juvenile inmates.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. Then I'm coming back here and go to college and see what they know. And then I'm going to build things.
That's Jimmy Stewart as George Bailey, of course, in It's a Wonderful Life. And things don't quite work out the way young George is hoping that they will. And a lot of things about the movie didn't go as originally planned either. Our next guest shares some of the stories behind the classic holiday movie as people settle in to watch it maybe over the next week. Jennifer Wood is senior editor at mentalfloss.com, and her piece 25 Wonderful Facts About It's a Wonderful Life is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, this movie, it's a really big deal now. Everyone's heard about it. It's a classic. But it wasn't a big hit when it came out, was it?
No, and that's actually kind of the funniest part of the film is that when it was released in 1946, it was a bit of a bomb at the box office. It did receive a number of Oscar nominations. It did not win any of them. But it wasn't until about 30 years later that it really became a classic. And the reason that happened was because the copyright on the film lapsed, meaning that any television station that wanted to show the movie could do so without having to pay royalties. So anyone, and that happened in about 1974. So from 1974 to 1994, you know, anyone that grew up or watched television during that time would see it almost on a loop during
right.
the holidays.
There was that period where it seemed ubiquitous. Every time, as you said, yeah. you turned on the TV, there it was. And then all of a sudden, pop, it was gone.
Exactly. And that's because in 1994, they got the rights, the copyrights back, so that people actually had to start paying now to show the movie again.
Well, going back to the very beginning, what was the original inspiration for the movie?
It's actually a really interesting inspiration. It started, I guess the best way to, would be to call it a Christmas card. It was almost more like a Christmas newsletter. There was a writer named Philip Van Doren Stern who had written a short story called The Greatest Gift. And he'd sent it for years. He actually tried shopping it to publishers with zero success in doing that. So one year for Christmas, he just decided that, you know, hey, this isn't out there on the market yet. So he actually gifted it to some of his closest friends and family members for the holidays. I think he printed up about 200 copies of the story and sent them out as part of a very large Christmas card for the year. And it just so happened to get into the hands of a film producer at RKO Pictures who read it, loved it, and purchased the movie rights to it for about $10,000 at the time.
Wow, it's kind of a fairy tale story for the person who wrote it. Somehow it finds
exactly.
its way into the hands of a film producer and goes on to become this beloved classic. But it apparently changed a lot in its iterations as it went through screenwriters, right?
It did, and it actually has, if you look at it, I mean, a lot of movies these days, you'll see a number of writers on it. But in my opinion, at least, it's kind of what makes the movie, you know, we look at that movie and always think, oh, it's this very sentimental, you know, really sweet movie. And really, there's a very cynical and dark side to it. And I think some of that you could attribute to the number of writers who did work on the film. Over the years. Originally, when RKO purchased the rights, the plan was to have Cary Grant star in it. And they tried to make that work for a little while. And then in 1945, Frank Capra actually bought the rights to it and immediately brought Jimmy Stewart on to star in the movie. But over the course of its production, they had more than half a dozen people took turns at kind of tweaking parts of the screenplay, including Dorothy Parker, Dalton Trumbo. So they had really, typical screenwriters, and they had very well-known writers at the time who all added a little bit of their own, their own voice to the script. And I think that's to a large degree, why it is such like sort of a layered and complex movie when you look at it, really.
Well, we're learning some little-known facts about the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life with Jennifer Wood from mentalfloss.com. And here's something that was really surprising to me. This was, it's a winter movie. There's falling snow, but it was filmed in the summer.
Yes, such is the trouble, I guess, sometimes when you're filming a movie. They filmed it not only in the summer, but in the midst of a heat wave. So eagle-eyed viewers watching the movie might notice at certain points that Jimmy Stewart happens to be sweating a little bit. And that's because he's all bundled up and in the middle of the summer, in the middle of a heat wave. So they did have to sort of, make accommodations for that, do shorter shoots, stop a little bit. But yes, and at the same time, they needed snow, clearly, which is its own character almost in the film.
Right, and the snow is really well done. I watched this recently, and I thought, the snow looks surprisingly realistic. It's kind of impressive for the time.
It is, and Capra, who actually trained as an engineer, he sort of was an engineer before he got into filmmaking. At the time, usually snow was painted cornflakes, was kind of the most common thing that you'd use for fake snow. So he actually engineered a new way of creating fake snow, and essentially it's what you'd find, it's fomite, so what you'd find in a fire extinguisher. He mixed it with sugar and water, and then he created snow.
Wow. Well, it sounds like there is a little bit of maybe grappling for the title of where the real Bedford falls in, but there's a town in New York that might be the one. So is this a real town, Bedford Falls?
Bedford Falls itself is not is a fictional town. It was built, on a set. But there's a town in New York, Seneca Falls, it's called, and they actually dub themselves the real Bedford Falls. And if you can actually go onto their website, which I believe is actually therealbedfordfalls.com, and they have photos showing you what the town looks like. And kind of seeing that, like, oh yeah, this looks familiar. Anyone who's seen the movie, but each year, it's really kind of a charming little event they do. Is they throughout the month of December, they just have a really jam-packed calendar of holiday-themed events that they do, lightings and screenings of the movie, and a lot of times they'll get people who participated in the movie to come and share stories of it. So. They take that title very seriously and really make a major event out of it. And people come from all over each year to visit the town and their holiday celebration.
Now, sometimes when there's a big cultural hit like this that everybody likes and watches over the years, you hear later that the people who are actually in the movie, the stars, didn't actually like it. How do the key players feel about this one?
Oddly, actually, Capra, Stewart and Reed have all at different times and not sitting down together, but all at different times have said that it's the favorite movie that they've ever made. So they all really, loved the experience and loved the final result, more importantly.
And there's some little details, as you watch it, there are these little nuggets that have caused speculation over the years. One of these is there's a police officer and a cab driver named Bert and Ernie in the movie. And you got to go, hey, Bert and Ernie, is there any connection there?
Yes. And that's actually been asked, I think, many, many times over the years. And a person that worked very closely with Jim Henson for many years said that, swore that he said we'd never had a conversation about it directly. It had obviously been brought up on a few occasions. But he said that one of the things of all Jim Henson's many talents, he said that his memory for something like that is not something that that was he would not have remembered that those were the two names. So people close to Henson swear that that was completely coincidental. But a fun little thing to see when you're watching the movie.
And of course, the natural question here is there going to be a sequel to this thing or a reboot? Have you heard anything about that?
Well, in I guess it was 2013, there were a couple of producers who, you know, made a big announcement that they'd be continuing the story with a sequel. And I think they were going to call it, you know, The Rest of the Story or something like that, which had been planned for a release this year. In very short order, Paramount, who owns the rights to the film, you know, stepped in, said, no, this is not happening. That they would need, you know, to purchase the rights, and that, you know, without a license from Paramount, no sequel would ever happen, and that, you know, they were not interested in seeing that happen. So people have announced it, but the likelihood of that ever happening, I don't think is very likely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about all these things today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Jennifer Wood. She is a senior editor at mentalfloss.com, and she shared facts about It's a Wonderful Life in her article, which you'll find linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. From the days of Occupy Wall Street to the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, there's been a lot of attention paid to income equality in the United States and the divisions between the top 1% and everybody else. Our next guest says we should also be paying attention to income equality among cities around the country and regions. He writes that there's been a big shift where incomes between cities like New York and San Francisco and Milwaukee were getting closer and closer to one another until around 1980. In the last couple decades, they've been growing farther and farther apart, with big winners and big losers. And he says there are some fundamental policy decisions that are behind that change. Philip Longman joins us now. He's policy director and managing editor of the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation. And his piece on the growing economic divide between American cities is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Philip, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that for a long time, American cities were converging. Incomes, that is, were getting closer together from about 1940 to 1980. Can you paint us a picture of what was going on then in cities around the country?
Actually, this trend goes back even farther beyond 1940, that gradually the different regions of America grew closer and closer in their standards of living. So partly this is a story of the South gradually catching up with the North in its level of industrial development, but it was also a story of the Plain States and the Mountain West catching up with the East Coast. So if we follow this trend to its climax, sometime in the late 60s, the per capita income of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for example, was basically the same as that of the New York metropolitan area. Milwaukee, Rockford, Illinois, these were cities that had per capita incomes that were within shouting distance of the per capita income of cities like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And there were many different reasons we can talk about why those incomes were converging towards what came to be known as the single American standard of living. But since about 1980, those trends have been pushed into reverse. And so now almost all of the gains in wealth and income that we see in the country as a whole are concentrated in a few elite cities.
And what does that spread look like today?
Well, the picture we see today is one in which a few elite cities, Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, are pulling farther and farther away from the rest of America. Certainly what's come to be known as flyover America, the great Midland heartland of America. It's once major cities like St. Louis, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, are falling farther and farther behind their per capita income as compared to, say, New York. But it's, some people would say, well, that's just because those are Rust Belt cities. They have a declining manufacturing base and like that. But it's also true if you look at the the supposedly vibrant Sunbelt cities like Atlanta or even Houston at the height of the oil boom was falling farther and farther behind San Francisco, New York, Boston, Washington. So that's the new face of regional inequality in America, and it turns out that much of the inequality between the 1% and all the rest actually deconstructs to a regional inequality growing up between these elite coastal cities and flyover America.
So why should that matter to us, that beyond this, the 1% in individuals, that they're also located within particular cities? Why does that matter?
Well, it certainly matters if we have shared prosperity. So if you happen to be in one of these cities that is not participating in the growth of the country, life is getting increasingly uncomfortable. And I think it's also politically dangerous. We had generations and generations of Americans before us who worked very, very hard to close the gaps between certain the different regions of the country so that there would be a single American standard of living and so that we would not be set against each other sectionally as we once were in the Civil War, for example, right? And so it's also when you get into it and you look at the particular reasons why these few cities are doing so much better than the rest of the country, they're not particularly noble reasons. They're reasons that have to do with what economists often call rent-seeking. That is, in New York's case, it's largely built on financial speculation and manipulation. In the case of San Francisco, it's increasingly Bay Area, increasingly based on patent monopolies and other things that aren't actually creating wealth but rearranging wealth.
We're talking with Philip Longman right now from the New America Foundation, talking about his recent piece on income inequality among American cities. And he says that there are haves and have-nots in different parts of the country, but it has not always been that way. And Philip, you say there are some major public policy decisions at work here and that laws relating to monopolies were a big part of that picture. But for starters, how did things used to work in a time when incomes were coming closer together and we had that one American standard of living that was emerging?
Well, going back to the 19th century, one thing that our previous generations of Americans were very sure to make happen was that they wanted to equalize the access and pricing of transportation throughout the continent. So as railroads came into being a major source of transportation, one of the things that first became a big problem with railroads is that they tended to engage in price discrimination between different regions of the country. So out in Wisconsin, particularly 100 years ago, they had a gigantic movement of farmers and people associated with agriculture who realized that they were completely at the mercy of mostly Eastern-owned railroads and that these railroads engaged in price discrimination in ways that meant that folks in the Midwest were competing not on the basis of who could produce the best grain or the best manufacturing items, but on who had the best access to favorable freight railroad rates. And so, you know, we set up an institution known as the Interstate Commerce Commission as early as 1887 that basically controlled the prices and equalized the prices of everything that moved in the United States across state lines. And most states had their own versions of that to control it within state lines. And that system lasted up in through the early 1980s. And as new technologies like airlines came along, we applied the same standard to airlines, which meant that back in the 60s or 70s, right, the level of service that a city like Milwaukee would experience, airline service, was not fundamentally different than that of any other city, and that the pricing was equalized. Today, of course, we've deregulated airlines, and we've deregulated trucks, and we've deregulated everything that moves, basically. And what that means is both the pricing and the level of service on airlines, for example, is vastly different from one city to another. And mostly what it means is that the mid-sized cities of America, in sort of flyover America, basically don't have the connectivity to the rest of the country and the rest of the global economy that they need to, for example, be a viable headquarters for a Fortune 500 company. You know, we've seen Fortune 500 companies moving out of places like Cincinnati simply because air service has deteriorated so much. That's the kind of thing that public policy, going back to the railroad era, you know, made very sure didn't happen, but is happening now again. It's happening in railroads and freight rates on railroads, which matter a lot to grain shippers in the Midwest. They now find themselves living in a world that predates 1887 in terms of its level of laissez-faire. And we have, you know, single railroads like the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, you know, basically controlling vast swaths of the rail infrastructure on monopolistic terms. So these things, too, tend to push us towards greater regional inequality.
Now, you write that change started to happen in the Carter administration. What happened then?
Well, in the 70s, it was an era of high inflation, and many liberals were very concerned that inflation was, you know, a serious problem for which liberalism was largely being blamed at the time, and looked around for solutions. And unfortunately, a lot of people at that era forgot why some of these policies that had been put in place, you know, going back to the mid-19th century, what their ultimate rationale was and why they were still needed. And so I think, especially in the case of airline deregulation, it was people were thinking, well, if we deregulate it, we'll get cheaper prices. And we desperately need cheaper prices because we're living in this era of terrible inflation. And the first-order effect of that deregulation was cheaper prices. But, you know, two mistakes were made. One is they forgot that with deregulation, you minimally had to have very strong antitrust enforcement, or all the airlines would eventually merge with one another and engage in monopolistic prices. And that's essentially what has happened now. We're now in an era, in a world in which there's only four major carriers left in the United States, and most cities, even large cities, are captive to only one of them, which means that whether they rise or fall in the world depends on the contingencies like how some particular airline decides to price its tickets and what kind of service it decides to offer. And so previous generations of Americans would just never stand for that. They would say, no, that's a public decision. We want the economy, we want market structured so that people are competing on the basis of things other than who happens to have favorable access to transportation costs.
We're talking to Philip Longman right now from the New America Foundation, talking about his recent piece on income inequality among American cities. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this, that there is more income inequality among American cities, among regions of the country? And what do you think needs to be done, if you think anything needs to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation now with Philip Longman with the New America Foundation, and he says we should be paying more attention to a growing income gap among American cities and making policy changes so that we don't turn into a nation of regional haves and have-nots. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Why do you think some cities and regions are booming while others have been on the decline? Do you think this is a problem that needs a solution? And do you think there's a national solution, or is it up to state and local governments to deal with their own economies? How do you see Milwaukee and other cities around Wisconsin fitting into the national economic landscape? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Philip, is there any indication with the Founding Fathers about their intent when it comes to income distribution around the country?
Well, the Constitution itself sets up a Senate and a House, which that can be looked at, particularly the Senate, as a way of giving disproportionate influence to the rural areas and underpopulated areas of America to make sure that they have a voice in national affairs. And the post office, a lot of people don't realize it, but the postal service is actually written into the Constitution. The founding fathers understood that they couldn't rely on a private company to deliver equal levels of service at equal prices when it came to delivering the mail across the continent. So they made it a constitutional requirement of government that that kind of equalization of services be provided. They also, if you go back from basically 1980 all the way back to the founding of the country and even farther before that, right, there were various common laws in place that prevented the emergence of entities of anything like the scale of, say, Walmart or Amazon. You know, those of us a certain age can remember in the 1960s, they had supermarkets. Some of them had names like the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, the old AMP, for people who remember that. But, you know, federal policy made sure that in any given market, no grocery chain or chain store of any kind would have more than 7 or 8% of the market share, because people understood how the importance of local economies and keeping the money in circulation locally, not having it all siphoned off to distant headquarters cities. So we had modernization of retailing, but nothing like Walmart. And that worked. Those laws began to be dismantled in the 1970s. The result now is that most economies are effectively colonized. Most of the economic decisions that happen in most communities in America aren't made in those communities. Most of the money spent in those communities ultimately leaves those communities. It's spent at Walmart and goes somewhere else, right? It's spent at Amazon, goes somewhere else.
And I want to jump in so we can get a caller in on this. We've got Majid joining us in Chicago. Majid, hello.
Yeah, hi there. Excellent show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It really very knowledgeable, and it teaches a lot. Okay, I would like to basically pronounce myself as a Muslim socialist, which is a very rare combination, by the way. You don't run across too many Muslim socialists these days. My comment relating to your excellent show for today is that it is absolutely the job of the federal government to make sure that the entire land is fair and equitable, and no one has any particular monopoly or advantage or disadvantage in this whole big equation of ours called U.S. of A. So, yes, it is upon the federal government responsibilities, I think, to make it all good, equitable, and, you know, equal playing field.
Thank you so much for your comment. Appreciate that, Majid. And so here we are now with these income disparities among cities. Is it the responsibility of the federal government? If we want to change this, where do we turn from here, Philip?
Well, I think it is the responsibility of the federal government to help structure markets in ways that they do not become monopolized. And this is not some radical socialist idea. This is an all-American idea that goes back at least to the 1830s, and the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1890, so there's nothing new or radical about it. Ironically, the so-called laissez-faire policies of the 19th century involved a lot more direct hands-on government control than we have today. In terms of, because I was explaining earlier, you know, directly setting prices in transportation, directly intervening in mergers to make sure that regional economies weren't surpassed. Some people think that there's some inevitability, some technological inevitability to all this. This is brought to you by the digitalization of the economy or the globalization of the economy. But one of the things I like to remind people of is when the internet was still brand new and futurists were trying to guess what would be the effect of having this new technology that would allow anybody to communicate with anybody anywhere in the world anytime for free, right? What would be the effect? And everybody predicted that it would be, as they put it at the time, the death of distance, right? It would mean that it would no longer matter, you know, whether you were in downtown Manhattan, New York, or you were in a tree hut in Oregon. You would have equal access to the world economy. And in a purely technological sense, we do have that, right? Technology has amazingly democratized access geographically, and yet we see that the effect is to have the where you live be all and more determinative of how you do. So it's not something that's happening because of technology. It's something that's happening despite technology, which shows you how much is being brought to you by other forces.
Now, Philip, we've just got a couple of moments left here. How hopeful are you that this will become part of the conversation among policymakers?
Well, I'm very hopeful because I think all it takes is for it to be pointed out to folks and they instantly recognize it as something that's true. I'm also hopeful because previous generations of Americans knew how to deal with this problem and did deal with it. They successfully wrestled it to the ground to the point by the late 60s we had basically no regional inequality in the United States anymore. So they could do it. We could do it. It took them, you know, many, many decades to get it done. It won't happen for us overnight, but it's not like we have to invent something that's never been invented.
And Philip, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
That was Philip Longland, Policy Director and Managing Editor of the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation. Well, you might not know it here in Wisconsin, but winter does begin in earnest today. The weather outside is decidedly not frightful, and instead it's kind of warm and gray and soupy, at least so far. Michelle Goods, our technical director, she's always in the studio here with us. And Michelle, there is one bonus this week. There is going to be a full moon on Christmas.
That's right. It's the first full moon in 34 years, and there won't be another one until 2034. So I guess there's that to make up for it, if you're especially thrilled about a brown Christmas.
Or maybe a brown winter in general,
oh, yeah.
It maybe looks like. And we'll be talking about this, by the way, tomorrow on Central Time, asking how you feel about a brown winter and it looks like a brown Christmas.
I don't know. I think the lack of snow has lulled me into this false sense of security. I'm feeling panic, and I don't normally feel panic at Christmas time.
Yeah, meaning it seemed like there was lots of time until the holidays hit because there was no snow yet, so you could take all the time you wanted to shop and do whatever you had to do it, but all of a sudden, boom, it's here.
Usually that first snowman indicates like it's time to get to work, and this year all we had were mud men to make. That was all you could make was a mud man.
Not quite as much fun.
No.
I don't know. It's a trade-off, right? The snow. No polar vortex this year, but no snow either.
Yep.
Well, we'll do our best.
It's the most